This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Monday, with at least 1,000 homes burnt across the country and dangerous fire conditions still building, how are Australians reacting to the return of their Prime Minister and his vows not to change his government's climate policies? And we'll also bring you a bit of light relief from the satirists at the Batuta Advocate. We begin in South Australia, where the scale of the destruction from the deadly Adelaide Hills bushfires is becoming even more apparent this lunchtime. One man died in the fire and another is in a critical condition in hospital, and authorities now say that the massive blaze destroyed more than 80 homes, along with several hundred other buildings. And firefighters are facing yet another high fire danger day. Our reporter Rhett Burney is in Adelaide. Rhett, just how worrying are the conditions facing these exhausted firefighters today?
Yeah, Eleanor, they're pretty concerning when you consider the amount of fire activity we've seen in the last 3 days. The fact that most of the fire isn't yet out, there still are pockets of smouldering trees and pockets of smouldering paddocks, as well as homes that have been lost. So these conditions today, where we're seeing potentially more winds coming up through the hills, have certainly got authorities worried about that. Now, obviously, as well, on top of that, they're contending with the dangerous conditions where trees that have already been burnt are dropping limbs. There's a lot of danger on the roads as well. So people are being told to stay right away from this area. As you can imagine, it is an unfolding event. There's still a lot that's happening out there. There's still a lot of a firefight to go.
And Rhett, the news of 72 families left homeless was horrific. Now the authorities have scaled that up to 80. Do they know whether this is the full extent of the damage from the weekend's fires?
No, not yet, actually. At this stage, now 82 homes confirmed gone, over 500 buildings are confirmed gone, and hundreds of cars as well. So at this stage, no, it's not yet clear if that will be the final number. We are being warned that it could certainly rise again. Obviously, yesterday it was at 72, overnight it rose to 82. So you can imagine that there's a lot of work that's going on. Rapid assessment teams are going out there, but there's a lot of areas that aren't safe enough to get to. I spoke with one of the people that lost his home. His name's Mark Webb, and here's what he had to say.
We basically had time to grab our hard drive with photos, so we got those. So we got our photographic memories, which is good. We got that, and that was it. And we decided to leave, and then some neighbours who stayed, and they managed to save their house, but they said our house was gone within half an hour.
It's amazing the optimism of people who lose their homes, isn't it? That's Mark Webb there. Rhett, the Premier, Stephen Marshall, has been on the fire ground today. What's he had to say?
Yeah, the Premier, Stephen Marshall, has been out there. He's actually been out the last couple of days. Yesterday he was in Kangaroo Island, where we saw fires there. At least one home was destroyed on Saturday there. This morning he was at Belhanna, which is up in the Adelaide Hills. Now, I think that he's also just seeing just how devastating these fires are as well. The degree of the devastation is quite clear just in the pictures, but the hills are only just up the road from the city. You're talking about multiple families that live up there because they're able to get to work and all that sort of stuff, but also enjoy a country lifestyle. And that complete area has been almost decimated. Here's what he had to say.
I'm quite amazed that there's only been one fatality. The catastrophic conditions that we had on Friday were just extraordinary. Real scenes of devastation here in our state.
That's South Australian Premier Stephen Marshall, our reporter in South Australia, Rhett Burney. Well, now to New South Wales, where terrifying fires also tore through a number of communities over the weekend, destroying at least 100 homes and buildings. Milder conditions today are giving crews time to try to contain some fires and assess the damage, but the threat is far from over. In the Blue Mountains, authorities are concerned that two massive fires may join up, and just south of Sydney, a large fire remains uncontained. Julia Holman reports.
Rural Fire Service Captain Brendan O'Connor has been on the front line for weeks defending his community of Balmoral in the New South Wales Southern Highlands, 100 kilometres southwest of Sydney. He had braced his community for the worst.
There was enough evidence there, enough reports that we were in for a hell of a time, and unfortunately that's what we did end up with.
He told RN Breakfast that over the weekend he and his crew put every effort in and fought the fires until their tanks ran dry and they ran out of water.
That was a terrible moment where we had, you know, eight fire appliances dealing with this firestorm, and there was no water left. The bulk water truck that was there had been drained. All our water tanks at our fire station had been drained, and we had no water.
It was a horror weekend around New South Wales. As well as an estimated 20 homes in Balmoral, many more were damaged or destroyed in the Gross Valley Fire and the Gospers Mountain mega blaze to the city's northwest. Several homes also went up in the Currawan Fire on the state's south coast. 800 homes have now been destroyed statewide this fire season, and it's believed around 100 were lost over the weekend.
There's still a lot of work. I think it'll be another 24 hours before you get an accurate number, but I think it is fair to say it is in that 100. It is around 100.
Rob Rogers is a Rural Fire Service Deputy Commissioner. He says the natural environment is facing a crisis like never before.
This being 3 million hectares of forested areas, you know, that's got serious ecological impacts as well as the fire impact as well, and I think that'll be felt for years to come.
He says all efforts are now going into trying to contain several fires, including in the Blue Mountains.
Hopefully, if crews can get these backburns in place, we can start to reduce the threat to the Blue Mountains.
This week, there is expected to be some relief from the catastrophic conditions. The Bureau of Meteorology's Rob Taggart says rain is forecast to hit the fire-affected areas along the south coast and possibly also the Blue Mountains.
There could be a couple of millimetres. The trouble is with a little bit of rain, but not much. It does create problems for backburning operations and hazard reductions preparing for the next big fire day. So sometimes a little bit of rain can be a little bit of a nuisance for that kind of activity.
And he says more hot weather is forecast to hit before the end of the year.
Maybe the 30th or 31st is when we start to see some more heat coming through.
The state's Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, is warning that there is a long road ahead. But she says she's grateful the damage over the weekend wasn't even worse.
We've lost 8 people during this season in tragic circumstances, and that toll could have been far worse.
The Premier has toured the Blue Mountains while defending criticism from the New South Wales Labor opposition that more money should be diverted to frontline efforts.
Our government provides $1.7 billion every year to our emergency services personnel.
But in the Blue Mountains, the strongest criticism is reserved for the Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Susan Alexander is from the town of Dargan, and her home went up in flames over the weekend. She's denounced the decision by Prime Minister Scott Morrison to holiday in Hawaii as the state burned.
I find appalling what our Prime Minister has done, his lack of leadership. There's no empathy. Why would you go on holiday when you're a leader and your country is burning?
That's Susan Alexander, who lost her home over the weekend. Julia Holman, our reporter. Well, despite the criticism from constituents like Ms. Alexander, the Prime Minister is heading out to some fire-affected communities today and says he regrets taking his Hawaiian holiday. But Scott Morrison is insisting he won't change his government's climate policies, even though the acting Prime Minister and leader of the National Party claimed over the weekend that the government did need to do more. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
As bushfires scorch the earth, the government's feeling the political heat. The Prime Minister's decision to take leave in Hawaii last week is one issue. Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce took to Channel 9 today to defend him.
Even during a war, at some stage, the general takes some time off. You know, even people in the middle of a bushfire, there comes a time where they say, mate, you've got to go back and have a rest. Now, the reason we have a Deputy Prime Minister is they fill in that space, that you do have a point of reference.
And over the weekend, the current Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, certainly seemed to provide a new point of reference for the other political issue facing the government, its climate change policies. He suggested that more needs to be done. Sydney Radio 2GB host Mark Levy asked Scott Morrison about those comments this morning.
It seems your deputy is being brainwashed by these environmentalists, with Michael McCormack saying Australia must increase its efforts to tackle climate change, and the bushfires have increased community fears about global warming. Is there a divide in the coalition at the moment on this issue?
No, I don't think so at all, Mark. I mean, we're saying the same thing. I mean,
But you're not saying the same thing, though, Prime Minister. When you're saying that there's no change, and he's saying that we need to increase our efforts, that's a difference.
Well, our existing policies have increased efforts, Mark, so that's the point.
Criticised for going missing last week, Scott Morrison kicked off this week by doing the breakfast programs on commercial radio and TV.
And Scott Morrison joins us now live. Good morning to you, Prime Minister. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
And the Prime Minister joins me now from Kirribilli House in Sydney. Prime Minister, good morning and welcome home.
Channel 9 host Jonathan Upton confessed he's having a harder think about climate change as the bushfires went from bad to worse.
Do we need to act now?
Well, we are acting now. Australia's Australia's emissions are 50 million tonnes on average lower every year under our government than the previous government.
But the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, says the government's not doing enough.
He sent Minister Angus Taylor across to Madrid to argue for an accounting fiddle because Australia not only is not encouraging the world to do more, they're encouraging the world to do less.
And he says the government is split on the question of what to do about climate change.
So anyone who looks at the Deputy Prime Minister's comment, who said that there needs to be change, and looks at the Prime Minister, who says nothing to see here, knows that they are at odds.
And when he's not being asked about climate change, the Prime Minister's still facing a barrage of questions about last week's leave, like this one from Channel 7's Monique Wright.
Why was your judgement so off, and why did it take you so long to come back after you said that you were going to?
Well, Monique, that's your take on the events. I mean, 7 weeks ago we'd planned this. But look, we all make decisions, Monique. You do as a parent, I do as a parent. We all seek to balance our work-life responsibilities and we all try and get that right.
The Prime Minister Scott Morrison under pressure there. Tom Eildon reporting. Well, the Australian Industry Group is now calling on the Prime Minister to divert the budget surplus to help rebuild communities devastated by bushfires and boost the economy. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan reports that retailers are facing their worst Christmas shopping season since the global financial crisis more than a decade ago.
This year's pre-Christmas buying spree looks like being the most subdued since 2008, back in the depths of the global financial crisis. Even so, Russell Zimmerman, Executive Director of the Australian Retailers Association, is remaining positive.
The drought and the fires have impacted on retail, but I'm pleased to say that yesterday, walking around the shops, it appeared to be quite busy and it looked like people were really getting to the Christmas spirit.
Russell Zimmerman predicts this year's Christmas spending will top $53 billion. But unlike previous years, the drought and now bushfires has prompted more spending in regional communities.
We know from talking to retailers that there's been a lot of support for regional and country areas and for unique products. That's good because obviously those areas have done it really tough over the last 12 months or thereabouts with the drought. So people have thought about their country folk and that's obviously a good thing for the country.
The Commonwealth Bank's household spending intentions is also subdued with less spending on goods as consumers move from traditional gifts to experiences and donations. The CBA's chief economist Michael Blythe says consumers are nervous about their household budgets despite efforts to boost confidence.
I mean, they've been given plenty of opportunity in a sense. We've had a series of rate cuts, lower mortgage payments, tax rebates flowing through, and of course rising house prices and a pretty solid labour market. So overall, it's a good backdrop, but we're just not seeing the follow through.
So not a festive spirit, and that's not being helped by what we're seeing from bushfires and drought.
Absolutely. So we've seen a pretty steady deterioration in consumer sentiment since the middle part of the year, but certainly things like bushfires and the smoke haze in places like Sydney are not going to help that.
But the devastation goes beyond consumer spending. Innes Willocks, Chief Executive of the Australian Industry Group, says the next set of economic growth numbers could stall as the impact of bushfires and drought eats into almost every sector of society.
We're starting to see a dramatic slowdown in tourism numbers, delayed deliveries. We're seeing delays in public transport. We're seeing road closures which are impacting people movement. These bushfires are very clearly having an impact on economic activity as a result of natural disasters like this.
So when you combine that economic drag, people not spending, bookings being cancelled, demand slowing, what sort of hole or stall do you think we'll see in the next set of economic numbers?
We're running pretty close to the edge, and it's not just going to be the immediate short term, it's going to be longer term too.
In Dennis Willock says the Prime Minister's ambition to deliver a budget surplus might need to be reviewed.
Well, it may be in the end, Peter, that there isn't much choice here. We need to rebuild communities. So there is going to need to be some sort of significant government response to these activities.
That's AI Group Chief Executive Innes Willocks, ending Peter Ryan's report. This is The World Today. Victoria's longest-serving Labor Premier John Kane has died. Mr. Kane suffered a stroke 2 weeks ago and was being treated at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. His family has released a statement overnight, as David Sparks reports.
Born at the height of the Great Depression in 1931, John Kane rose through the ranks of the Victorian Labor Party to become the state's 41st Premier. His election in 1982 ended decades of Conservative rule.
Well, we're in power for the first time for 27 years. And we can do things in this state.
John Kane's father, who bore the same name, served as Premier three times between 1943 and 1955. Mr. Kane Jr. was hugely popular for most of his first two terms until the stock market crash of 1987. During this period, his government propped up the massive Alcoa aluminium plant in Portland, a symbol of the state's economic renewal. He imposed a ban on poker machines and casinos, legalised brothels, and oversaw an expansion of the state's national parks.
State government may, if it has the desire and the commitment, shape the future in whatever way it sees fit.
But soon after Labor's narrow re-election in 1988, the state's economy nosedived along with the Premier's popularity. The collapse of the Pyramid Building Society and the Tri-Continental Bank amid rising debt and protests on the streets of Melbourne raised questions about John Kane's future.
I've indicated what my future is. I'm going to lead this government. We're going to win the next election.
But he failed to achieve party support for a package of spending cuts and tax rises and resigned as Premier in 1990. Joan Kerner was left to lead a party divided.
By the time Joan comes in as Premier, we're not united. That's the reason I had no authority left. It was very clear to me that the party wanted me out and somebody else might be able to pull it together, and that's what she sought to do.
In more recent times, he also took a swipe at Victoria's fixed parliamentary term introduced by the BRAC's Labor government.
The price of that four-year fixed term parliament is a legislative mess, I think.
One of Mr. Kane's final public appearances was at the farewell event for ABC Melbourne presenter John Fain, where he decried what he saw as the failure of today's political parties to develop strong policies.
They don't do it. There's a whole host of reasons. I won't take all your time this morning outlined, but there are many reasons. It's the decline in the thinking society and the decline in people having responsibility, not just for themselves.
John Kane's one-time political opponent, former Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett, has told Melbourne radio station 3AW he'll be remembered well.
He's made a profound contribution politically. He's been a true believer. He will be remembered, I think, fondly.
Former Labor Premier Steve Brax also paid tribute.
John was a breakthrough Premier of Victoria for the Labor side of politics in that for the first time in 27 years, he won with a significant majority in 1982. He held office for three terms. And, of course, he set up, really, the mode of moderate and modest Labor governments which have occurred ever since.
Mr. Kane is survived by his wife, Nancy. His family has released a statement saying they're grateful he enjoyed good health and remained very active prior to his stroke. They say he's much loved and admired by his family and will be greatly missed.
David Sparks reporting. If you're a well-informed millennial or just a lover of political satire, then you'll have heard of the Batuta Advocate. For those of you who haven't, it's one of the sharpest Australian news satire sites available, although its founders would insist it's not satire or fake news, but penetrating and incisive journalism. Those young founders joined me in the studio last month for what turned out to be one of our most popular interviews of the year. Clancy Overall and Errol Parker, welcome to the World Today studio.
Thanks for having us.
Congratulations on the success of the Batuta Advocate.
Congratulations on the success of the ABC.
It's 5 years since you launched online. How big is your audience now?
Big enough.
Big enough. Big enough, I guess.
It's a bit too big, actually.
Yeah, yeah. We're starting to kind of, we're starting to fly a bit close to the sun, but it's...
In the millions, that's a responsibility that we don't take lightly. But I think taking the newspaper online, I think, was one of the worst things I've ever done. It's kind of taken the mickey out of what our newspaper used to be.
Look, I was going to ask you that because you two were very much in charge of getting the Batuta Advocate started online. What skills do each of you bring to that challenge?
Well, to be honest, Eleanor, it wasn't our decision. We thought social media was a fad. We were happy to remain in print, just with the local circulation that was decreasing by the day. And it actually came down to an intern. She was a millennial, and she really pushed this whole Facebook thing on us and, Twitter. And, she nearly got sacked. She was completely out of school saying those kind of things to us and kind of patronising us with all this, techno-literacy. But we ended up kind of crumbling. Just what's the worst that can happen? And, obviously now we are in the millions.
Errol, you, of course, have got some history with News of the World.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did that help in bringing the Batuta online?
I think it prepared us well for our rapid growth. I think that certainly helped us.
Errol brought this unique skill set to the Batuta Advocate and where he was able to get inside people's voicemails.
From that experience with News of the World.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a reason he had to leave England with his brother's passport quite quickly. But, Batuta's always been welcoming people like Errol with open arms. It's a good place to go to keep your nose clean.
One of the distinguishing features of the Batuta Advocate is its capacity to see the links between big stories that other news outlets often miss. For example, today you're running the story, Angus Taylor squats and coughs out a couple of water licences during New South Wales police strip search. Now, what are you trying to do with that story?
I guess it's what New South Wales Police Commissioner Mick Mull is trying to do, which is to say that no one is above the law and he is willing to strip search someone who isn't necessarily an underage woman.
Well, another story that you've got an exclusive on, similarly linking two big yarns, is Westpac board members begin quietly applying for vacant treasury position at the Vatican. Now, how did you get hold of that exclusive?
Oh, well, we do have a number of reporters around the world. When that story first came across our desk, obviously we had to vet that with legal, and they said, as long as you can prove it, there's nothing you should worry about.
It was similar kind of advice that Malcolm Turnbull gave the Victorian police when it was time to bring the Cardinal home. If you can prove it, go ahead.
There's another story in today's Batuta Advocate. Desperate scientists form Hillsong rock band in last-ditch effort to get the PM to listen to them.
Yeah, I guess it's all about getting the attention of the powers that be. You could spend 10 years studying a specific field with an underfunded public institution, or you could get on stage and sing about faith. And that seems to have worked for the CSIRO scientists.
Yeah, because we had another story about a month ago about another way that the CSIRO was trying to get through to the Prime Minister, and that was they went around the office and they tried to find the bloke with the deepest voice. He was tasked with calling the Prime Minister and pretending to be God and just trying to put the hard word on him,
Science is climate science, Scott. You must change your ways.
Basically, it was all about convincing the Prime Minister that the bushfires that are currently ravaging four states across Australia weren't part of the rapture and that he probably should take this a bit seriously.
They're not part of my plan, Scott.
So what do you say to mainstream media sites that call your paper a fake news site or possibly worse, satire?
It's a petty label. It's up there with the fake news. I guess that comes down to a tall poppy. We try and avoid that term, but it does feel like that. It does feel like that. It feels like people aren't prepared to accept such a raw brand of independent regional news.
Now, even though they might deride you as fake news, some mainstream media organisations have been known occasionally to rip off your stories. Mm. Can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, there was one Errol wrote about
It was about a parking ranger who accidentally booked himself, and then that ended up on the Today Show where they were reporting it as a story that Channel 9 had broken itself, which, of course, was not true. And then it ended up on, the unsinkable Paul Barry's, hit show Media Watch. Channel 9 got the wrong end of the stick.
There's also a story that got picked up internationally about the Olympics.
Oh, yeah, that one about...
We said they were going to introduce... That was the story we broke about 3-on-3 at the Brazil.
3-on-3 basketball at the Rio Olympic Games that was ripped and stripped by a US, now defunct...
Sports publisher.
...newspaper called Deadspin.
Kind of spread that around the world, and it was a breaking Batuta story. Yeah. It actually ended up in the Washington Post. It was pure plagiarism. We were plagiarised all the way to the top.
the founders of the Batuta Advocate there. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Ange Lavoie-Pierre and the PM team will be along this evening, and we will be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.